Welcome to another edition of Homespun C-SPAN. Today we bring you the last section of the question and answer, the third part of three from a forum recorded November 17, 2005 at the Leadership Metro Richmond entitled Deconstructing Homelessness. Deconstructing Homelessness Forum featured Reggie Gordon, LMR graduate in 2002 and now the executive director of the William Byrd Community House. Reggie Gordon was also formerly the director of Homeward, a homeless services coordinating organization hosted at the United Way and source of much controversy among some homeless and homeless advocates. Also speaking will be Greta Harris, a senior program director of LISC, which provides matching funds to nonprofits that seek to build housing for lower-income people.
This is a really important conversation because when you go back to your families, your places of work, your places of worship, your community meetings, neighborhood associations, we hope that we all feel a little bit more empowered to stand up if someone's about to bring an SRO into your neighborhood, to your neighborhood, and you have to say, well, let me tell you how we can, why we should help them. Now, if you disagree, let's talk about it now, because we did that on staff at Homeward. We, you know, blah, 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 we talk about this, and then one day we said, what if an agency went to move next door to your home. We did not have a unanimous, we didn't have consensus with the Homeward staff because we said, well, it would depend on who's really going to manage it. It would depend on the lots of variables. So it's okay for us to be honest with each other to say, yeah, I moved to the far corners of Henrico or Chesterfield because I wanted the best education for my child. You know, if we dilute somehow, dilute's not the right word. If poverty moves around, does that mean you have to move, or do you?
That's what people do.
Well, yeah.
Well, that's what's happening. But I'll tell you that there's another faith-based group called RISC, Richmonders. I don't even know what it stands for. And involved. Or something with Richmond. Okay. It's a faith-based group mainly made up of suburban white congregations that want to be involved in trying to address social issues within our community. Good enough. And so they wanted to take on the issue of housing, which is cool, too, because you need lots of folks, you know, talking about this complex issue. And when I've gone to a gazillion meetings, so has Alice, probably so has Reggie, and we talked to folks, the same thing came up. People were saying, oh, folks ought to let poor people come and live and stuff. And I said, how many of you live in the city? Very few hands. All right. How many of you would be okay with a low-income person moving in next door to you? Well, we aren't talking about me. We're talking about everybody else ought to be. So when it becomes a personal issue, and you have to look yourself, each of us, not just you, all of us have to look ourselves in the mirror, what are we willing to do? And what's the litmus test? You know, when you look at if your mom or your aunt is, like even in the quality of housing that's done, my litmus test is what I want my mother to live in that housing. I don't want to just put up stuff that is just good enough. It needs to be quality work. It's not luxurious housing, but it certainly isn't just four walls and a roof.
But when the choice is to understand the grid versus the slum, I'll take the slum.
I wouldn't.
No, I wouldn't.
I think we as a society need to do better and raise the bar. I'm just saying what we try to do is raise the bar and ensure what we're doing is quality work. And when we have had some success in doing that. But when we do that, there's an income gap. So that when the quality work that we're doing, I can't serve the population.
Exactly.
Well, I'm just saying, but we are serving a lot of folks. Poverty is not one monolithic block of people.
Right.
It runs lots of different sectors.
Right.
So we're serving some, not all.
The two questions on this side, and we'll go to this side of the room. Okay.
Just kind of give you a background. I'm from Detroit, and my family moved from Tupelo, Mississippi, to work specifically at Ford Motor Company. And when my dad moved up, he was pretty much given a house for $5,000 in a little suburb of southern black families that moved to Mount Clemens, Michigan, which is southern of Detroit. And now, you know, my mother is just amazed that my family, you know, educated, hardworking, we don't have the same opportunities that they had when they were first starting out. And it took Katrina for us to realize just how close to that line we actually are. You know, I mean, I don't know what we would do if we ran from Chesterfield if a natural disaster came through and we were suddenly without, you know, without cars, without work, without, you know, homeowners insurance. I mean, renter's insurance just isn't all it's cracked up to be. And where do you manage that? I think that when people start talking about housing issues, there's a side to that that people forget about. They forget about your average 30-something young family. You know, I work in nonprofit, Don's production supervisor. We don't make a lot of money. And we're a lot closer to that line than we thought we were pre-Katrina. You know, before Katrina, you know, we thought we were fabulous. We were doing it. We were going to buy a house. And it was all good. But that's not the reality. And I always wonder, why isn't that conversation ever brought up with housing issues?
Well, I'll say that you're right. If I wish there were a way of really calculating, I think the folks, the numbers are staggering of folks who are on the edge economically. And I mean, again, it goes back to your point of the marketing from Madison Avenue. If you got to have the newest this, you got to have that. I'm trying to figure out what was wrong with this Coke. It's Coke with lime. So, you know, we're always trying to the newest and the best, and we're crazy enough to try to keep up with all of the newest stuff. And most of us, I would dare say, irrespective of what your income is, most of us live above our means. The credit card statistics nationally will prove that. And we are a paycheck or two away from being in crisis. We just deal with the folks who have already tipped over the edge and we're trying to get them back on solid ground. But there are no less than 6 different organizations right now in the Richmond region that are having conversations about the need for and value of quality, affordable housing. Richmond Association of Realtors is having dialogue. They have a new nonprofit that is trying to talk about this issue. The Urban Land Institute, which represents a lot of for-profit developers, has a new organization that is talking about this issue. The mayor has a regional task force on housing that is talking about this issue. The nonprofits have a trade association. We've been talking about this issue all along. But the definition of affordable housing runs the full gamut. If you're making $200,000 a year, I would dare say that you probably need affordable housing too, you know, housing that's affordable to you. So what's the real definition? The realtors and the for-profit developers' definition of affordable is very different from my definition of affordable, very different from Reggie's and Alice's definition of affordable. And so the dialogue is going, but people are trying to take one slice of the issue and deal with it, and they won't take on the whole kit and caboodle. And the whole kit and caboodle includes issues of race and class. And that's very difficult. And in our Southern gentility, we don't like to peel back and show our not-so-good side and talk about it. It's painful. It's difficult, and it's messy. But I think as a society, until we can actually talk candidly about those issues, it's almost impossible to get to the solutions.
I need help.
Okay.
I understand why 1,600 people on a given day is such an overwhelming number for us to deal with. Help me understand. If you have 6 organizations, as you have just said, who are having discussions about it, why can't those 6 organizations take 266 people each and work with them? That's 1,600 people. Help me understand.
Right here. But Alice, why don't you describe?
Well, I mean, the reason is because we're talking about people who are at 3% of area median income and below. Most of them have some kind of criminal background. They all have bad credit. And there's just not enough. I mean, we certainly don't have. We have waiting lists for our 2 SROs where a lot of them could go. No one wants to let us do another one anywhere. And so where can people go? We have some apartments, but they're full. And even if they weren't, some of these people actually can't afford those apartments. There are apartments out there. People cannot afford them that either have $291 in TANF and or are on disability and have $564 a month or, you know, in bad credit. I mean, that's the problem. And there are not enough rental subsidies so that people could actually have a subsidy in a regular apartment. But more than that, they don't have the credit anyway. So the regular apartment's not going to take these people because they have bad credit.
The other thing is that of the six organizations I was referencing, half of them aren't even thinking about dealing with that segment of the population. When the realtors and the for-profit developers are talking about we need more quality affordable housing, the average housing price to buy a home in the Greater Richmond region is just topped over $250,000. So in their mind, affordable is if we can get it down to $150,000. They're trying to target the police officers, the firefighters, where two
teachers.
Household incomes are maybe, you know, $60,000-$70,000 a year. Everybody's making $30,000-$40,000 each, and then you can afford, those folks, those households can't afford a $250,000 house or more. So that's the segment they're talking about. When you're starting to talk about when people have $8,000 a year, $10,000 a year, $5,000 a year, whole different ball game of trying to come up with the solutions.
Let's move around this side of the room. Okay.
Greta has a couple of times, I think, basically just done two things. She's called out for an acknowledgement of how big this problem is, and she has alluded to what it really is, and I want to try to describe it. This is a country that is by and large based on the notion of individual liberty being a condition precedent to collective equality. We have emphasized that ever since we broke away from the crown. Every study will show that if you poll Europeans, Asians, and Americans at how they balance the generally conflicting notions of liberty and equality, our country comes down with a huge emphasis on individual liberty is more important. The rest of the world is opposite. What I think we have to figure out, and this really lays down the scope of the problem, and maybe Leadership Metro Richmond is a good place to start, is how do we develop the level and capacity of leaders who can help to change the public perception of how people should think and how resources should be allocated to allocate them more towards collective social progress rather than individual and family achievement.
Running for elected office because I vote for you right now. I tell you, you know, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it just, I will tell you that Leadership Metro Richmond is a start. It's one of the solutions because I think the more we can have dialogue among each other, and just learn to know each other as individuals. And know your background, know your history, and vice versa, then we get to dispel the preconceived notions that we all have, the prejudices that we all carry about what does a middle-aged black woman, what is that person, a middle-aged white man, what is that person, and we get to know each other as Jack and Greta, then we're in a better position to sit down and have some interesting dialogue. I think one of the things, when I went through LMR in 95, one of the most telling things that still resonates with me today, we had our retreat when we were starting off the new year, and we did this thing where we went to different flip charts and we had to run to the area of a decade that resonated most with us, the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. Of course, I was a disco era late 70s. You know, that was me, all right? And so then the different groups started reporting out, and again, you know, it's typical LMR. It was racially and economically and sector diverse. And so the folks from the 50s were saying, oh, man, that was just great. We had poodle skirts. I don't know. I guess that's what it was, the hoop skirts or whatever. And we had sock hops or something like that. And things were great. And then Neverett Eggleston was in that group. And he said, I don't remember the 50s like that. And for those of you who don't know him, it's an older black gentleman who's a businessman, very prominent in Jackson Ward. He said, I absolutely don't remember the 50s like that. It was a very different perspective if you were living in a segregated society and couldn't go into Tallhammers. You couldn't go, you had separate but equal school systems. You had separate everything. And you were looked at as being less than 100% American or even human in some ways.
This is a Homespun C-SPAN on WRIR, and today we're bringing you Reggie Gordon and Greta Harris taking questions at the November 17th, 2005 Leadership Metro Richmond Forum called Deconstructing Homelessness. Reggie Gordon was the director of an effort called Homeward to coordinate homeless services in Richmond. Greta Harris is part of LISC that provides low-income loans for nonprofits seeking to build housing for lower-income folks.
So I think, you know, I raise a lot of money for our organization. That's what I spend an incredible amount of my time doing. And 95% of our money comes from white conservative Republicans. And most of it is reinvest it back into lower income, mostly black Democratic neighborhoods. And I, when we go out and talk, and we, you know, I'm trying to raise this money so we can make positive change occur, inevitably we talk about race. I raise money by talking about race. I play the race card. And it's, I don't bring it up, they bring it up. And we, because the wounds have not healed. The people, literally, in my lifetime, I went to segregated schools. In my lifetime, people were literally hosed down Main Street here in Richmond, in my hometown at Danville. And now the people who were washed down the street and the people who were holding the hoses are trying to sit at the table together and talk about the future of our community. And why can't we come together and why can't we address these issues? It's a small issue. 1,600 people. Why in the world can't we solve that? It's crazy. And but we can't get it. We got to be honest and candid about it. We still got some oozing going on. Well, I don't know about that. I think it's broader than that.
All 1,600, if the city would let her.
Why don't I go to this side of the room and we'll come back to this side.
Yeah, well, I just got a simple question. I'm in the residential lending arena. Help me feel less helpless to help the homeless. What do you need specifically? Is there a simple solution? Do you want us to take more risk and lend out with people that have the severe challenges that we have historically stayed away from? Or do you simply need our resources to put back into low-income housing? What, in your opinion, do you see as one of the solutions?
I was also answering that. I mean, part of the success in what I think community development has done over the last 30 years has been that we've proven to financial institutions and others that there are viable economic markets in concentrated, impoverished communities. And you have to change your underwriting a little bit. It may still be a little risky, but you can make money. And ultimately, that's, we want to attract private markets back into these communities. That's when systemic change will occur. I think it would be interesting to try to figure out how do you lessen the credit risk, or can we do credit enhancements to allow for different types of credit underwriting? And I don't know how you do with the criminal issue. I don't know how you deal with that to allow others to come in.
I mean, it just needs the organization that's willing to work with that element.
There are. I mean, we do. I mean, I think it's going to take a lot more than that. I think it's going to take some support of public policies that will change the actual dynamics of, for example, the criminal justice system. You know, it isn't about rehabilitating someone. That isn't what our criminal justice system is about. It's about punishing someone. And, you know, they may as well just leave people there for life because, really, they're going to commit crimes again because there's no place for them. You know, it's about trying to change public policy so that there will be more subsidies, you know, in the housing arena. But, you know, I think what we're focused on now is that subsidies are bad. You know, we shouldn't have subsidies in that. Really what needs to happen is people need to pick themselves up by their bootstraps and, you know, they don't need housing subsidies. Well, I'm sorry. There are some people that do need subsidies and will always need them. You know, it's not everybody, but, you know, we can't always pick ourselves up.
Well, and I would suggest that the way we're going now, more people will need subsidies. You know, we're all talking about how we want to be a part of the solution, but most of us probably still shop at Walmart, where people aren't making enough money to live on a day-to-day basis. I mean, that to me is how complex this is. And on one hand, we have this interest, but on the other hand, we're always looking for the, you know, the best price.
Well, do you know what the biggest subsidy is in the United States? You all know what it is. It's the mortgage interest deduction. I mean, I have it with my house. Everybody in this room, probably half the people in this room have it. They're talking now about tax reform and getting rid of that. Well, you know, it will never happen. It will never happen because everybody here in this room is going to fight to keep it. So it's like, okay, if you can fight for that, why can't you fight for more housing subsidies for our most vulnerable populations? That's really what it's about.
Well, just one observation. Just to take the completely opposite tack of what you're saying, which is, you know, it's only 1,600. I mean, perhaps that's the problem. I mean, if you're in a community of about a million people, and you only have this tiny number of people who are homeless, it's one of those things that
life goes on.
People, if we had 35,000 in a community of about a million, it might get a lot more attention, or it might. I'm sorry?
We will.
Well,
it's grown.
I mean,
every year it's grown.
I'm not advocating that thought process, or I wouldn't be in the room. But my point is, I do think that a lot of people look at it that way. I live in the city. I live in the fan. I see homeless people every day. They go through my trash regularly. I have neighbors who will chase them out of their garbage cans, which is astounding to me. But they do. They don't want them looking through their trash. Not in our neighborhood. That's not going to happen here. It's the most bizarre thing. Who cares if they go through the trash? But
half of them are probably VCU students.
No, not homeless people. That's the ones I'm talking about. But at any rate, I do think that if you're talking about 1,600 people, unfortunately, it's difficult to get the attention of the majority of the population.
And I would just say it goes back to something Ray said, is that it's 1,600 that are maybe homeless.
Right.
The numbers are significantly larger that are potentially ready to tip over the edge. And then there are even greater numbers that we're trying to serve that make a little bit. They're just squeaking by. So it's trying to reframe the issue a little bit is really important, because I think we're really smart people collectively in the greater Richmond area. This is an extremely generous and philanthropic community. We support lots of different things. It's not necessarily a money issue. It's a political will, and it's a societal will about, do we want to resolve this?
I think if it's presented as, maybe there are, it's a small number, but there are X thousands who are on the edge, who are a Katrina away or, a short disability
away, from.
That's why, as I mentioned earlier, it is reframing. And you all are in the room, we're all friends, colleagues. That's why we're using terms like solving homelessness, when it began, when it should end, things that may land in a way that, what are they talking about? Because we need to raise the awareness that this is not the issue. This is the issue. All the complicated, multi-layered challenges in America and poverty, those are the issues. The scapegoat has been, let's give some food to the homeless. So we need to change the language. I propose, and my staff and board, minimize the use of the term homelessness, because it's clouding what's really happening in our society.
Absolutely.
So, but that's why it's smoke and mirrors, maybe. However, if we don't do that, it'll be more palatable. It's already palatable. It's comfortable. We have to lose that comfort level with what happens day in and day out without having a natural disaster. I think you had a comment.
I think a big part of the problem is the public perception of homeless people, because that engenders in them a self-image. I speak as an ex-homeless person, and a self-image so that they won't take advantage of the opportunities and raise themselves up. And self-image problems are often symbolic problems. So I can mention just two small things that will significantly alter the self-image of homeless people. And that's, one of them is giving them IDs. Helping them get IDs. That just takes a few dollars. But a person who does not have a picture ID is a person without an identity. And then the second thing I want to mention is that the badge of the homeless person is bad teeth. And so what is the solution to bad teeth? Dental care. And that's what I wanted to add.
Dr. Kenneth Edwards is my brother. I'm a class of LMR 94. And it took my other brother and I 6 years to find my brother. And I have not really seen this group of people here, and this is for another meeting, address the problem that mental health has to do with homelessness. It's portrayed in the survey as possibly 7 to 8%. We talked about crime, we've talked about poverty, we've talked about families ignoring homeless, we've talked about drug abuse, alcohol abuse. Everything here mentioned today is not what happened in my family in regard to homelessness. It took my brother and I 6 years to find Kenneth, who graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Vanderbilt, has a PhD. The rest of us in our family are educated too, because of the lack of cooperation of neighborhoods, of police, of institutions that were supposedly helping the homeless. We were not able to find him. I hope you don't mind me saying this, but he never went for a homeless meal because we were taught not to accept charity. He never slept indoors at a facility providing for the homeless because we were taught not to accept charity. every morsel of food that went in his mouth was out of garbage can for 6 years. Now, I don't think we've mentioned this kind of homeless person here today. And I just told my brother about the meeting today. He said, let's go. But we've not heard anything about this kind of homelessness. And they are a portion of our 1,600, 1,400.
Mm-hmm. They are the entrenchers of the portion that make it such a big problem. It's just 1,600 people.
We're actually trying to start a program called Housing First, which is going to deal with specifically people with mental illness who are really not using the services for the most part. So we're working on that right now.
And one of the handouts that we will not get to because we don't need to, because this conversation was really significant and important, you'll see on here we've broken down the crisis of homelessness and the potential solutions, and you'll see Housing First bolded. Housing First would be the appropriate option. There are others, but that will something we need to add to our continuum of services for people who have mental health challenges who can't maintain their housing. But I thank you for being here and sharing because it does affect families. We've gone sort of full circle in our dialogue because the people that we're talking about, the 1,600, the thousands, it's somebody's brother, sister, cousin, you know, and there is this awful kind of disconnect, especially when there's a mental health issue. How do you find someone in New York City who grew up in Kansas but somehow made his or her way to New York and has gotten become a number, no identity on the streets of New York? That happens every day here.
Well, I had no identity because I was 1,000 miles away from home in Jackson, Mississippi.
But he was on the missing persons, the national missing persons list with the United States police, whoever the hell they are, for 6 years. We had him listed with as a missing person. And no police organization in the country, wherever he went, bothered to ask his name.
One of the solutions that we should all be proud of in our community is we have, through our five-year plan to end homelessness by next year, one of the things that we articulated is the need for a centralized intake process as well as the technology that links all the providers. Now, that was not easy. I mean, you would think that it makes sense, but because of how we are organized, there were issues of confidentiality. I don't want to share the names of my people with you. That goes to your point. That's why we can't help people as rapidly as we need to, because sometimes we're in the way. And that's the reality. I know, do we want to bring up Monroe Park? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm one of those Lower Fan residents who feels like that part of the city has given and supported and been the home to people without homes or with marginal housing for about long enough, and we would really like for Monroe Park to be a VCU student place again. And so we're very interested in the progress, and many of our people are extremely involved in the organizations that are under their home umbrella. But that's a topic that comes up again and again. The neighbors are doing lots of great things in there to make the park more attractive. I think it is coming along in a good way, but we do wonder about the potential for solutions to some of the problems that bring people there.
Thank you for thinking and caring about this issue. I'll recant one statement when I said that people don't care. I think they do care, but they care about lots of different things. And as is in human nature, people care about self and family, their own family first and foremost, and maybe that's cool. But I'm just saying, if sharing the caring a little bit more, we all benefit, and we are making progress. I don't want everybody to leave, oh, God, it was gloom and doom. We are making a lot of progress, and Richmond is a fantastic community, and we can be an even more fantastic community if we just do a little bit more and keep doing a little bit more.
In the room today, we had Alice from Virginia Supportive Housing, a solution. We have Mike Christian over here from The Healing Place, which is a solution for that target population of men with substance abuse issues. We have a centralized intake process now. We have the technology to link us all together. The congregations in Greater Richmond are trying to pool their resources. In Charlotte, they've done it. They did it 20 years ago. They have $9 million a year for prevention services. We're fractured still. So we can do it. You know, it's just a matter of having this kind of dialogue and having a different kind of conversation and reality check, as hard as it may be, about how do we deconstruct homelessness. So thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Homespun C-SPAN. Today we brought you the last portion of three of the question and answer sessions from a forum recorded November 17, 2005 at Leadership Metro Richmond entitled Deconstructing Homelessness. The forum featured Reggie Gordon, LMR graduate in 2002. Reggie Gordon is now the executive director of the William Byrd Community House, and Mr. Gordon was formerly the director of HomeWard, a homeless services coordinating organization hosted at the United Way and source of much controversy among some homeless and homeless advocates. Also taking questions was Greta Harris, the senior program director of LISC, which provides matching funds to nonprofits that seek to build housing for lower-income people. Join us every Monday at 12 noon for Homespun C-SPAN.